go ahead and reconvene. It's approximately 1:30. This is a call that I would remind you that you are still under oath. And I believe Mr. Hickey issues your witness.
Thank you, Mr. Burbidge. Good afternoon, Ms. Cole. Before we broke for lunch, we were visiting about what I introduced to you as some hypothetical assumptions I'd like you to make, and they were essentially these, that if you assume that the commission agreed with the position of the joint interveners and that the commission found that $13 million of this COPA filing was not recoverable as a wholesale commodity, you wouldn't have this imbalance with Basin if Basin took it out of the bill. Isn't that true?
You're making an assumption that Basin would be taking it out of the bill. And until such time as the contract was changed, which I'd assume would need a court to change, it would still be part of our wholesale power cost and therefore would still need to be paid to Basin.
Sure. And I think where we were at the exact point of breaking for lunch was, I think the question was along the lines of, in the event that the commission entered this order granting the relief the joint interveners are requesting, inevitably you'd sit down and visit with Basin and share the order and say, the commission just ordered that 13 of the $18 million in the COPA filing can't be recovered by us. We have an issue here, Basin. Don't you envision that conversation, whether you're at the table or whether Mike East is?
I agree that that conversation would likely happen. What I'm saying is that until the contract is changed, Precor would still have an issue in that they would have to pay those wholesale power costs.
You're not going to rush to pay a bill that the commission told you was wrongfully included as a part of your COPA filing because it didn't meet the requirements of Section 26.
Well, I think those are two separate issues.
I have nothing further for you.
Thank you, Ms. Treatman. Ms. Fish, do you have a question?
I do. I would like to follow up on some of the questions I asked Mr. Eastman. Were you aware that commission investigations have shown that Precorp has been implementing bills up to a month prior to their effective date?
Yes.
Is the cooperative willing to look into prorating bills?
We are willing to look into prorating bills. We don't have any objection in looking into that. We have had conversations with our software provider, and the way the software currently functions, there is only one rate for any particular billing month. So it would require software changes if we went down that path. What I think might be another option would be to implement, now that we've changed our billing cycles to be concurrent with calendar, to implement rates on the first of any calendar, which would prevent any need for proration.
And how would that work for customers that are only billed once a year if an effective date occurs in the middle of a calendar year?
Seasonal accounts would still have an issue, as Mr. Easley mentioned earlier, because those are annually billed. We would have to figure something out there different. I'm not sure how to accommodate that. Many of those accounts do not have monthly meter readings because they are only annually billed. So even a proration or a mid cycle, in that case, an annual cycle billing, we'd have to research that and work with the commission staff in determining what to do with that.
Now I'd like to ask you a few questions on the information used to calculate the COPA. Can you please describe your role in the development of the COPA?
Sure. Precorp provides the underlying forecasts for usage by class, and that in a relationship with the forecasts of purchase power. So our models that we use for budgeting are also used to develop those projections that are used as the underlying projections in the COPA modeling. We also provide all the actual billing data. So the COPA dollars that were collected that are entered into the model.
How do you create your projections?
Projections are created much like most RUS cooperatives are created. We look by class, by meter count, and then averages of usages in those particular classes by meter. Some are looked over a longer time frame due to take weather and those type of conditions out to weather normalized, so to speak. Some classes are looked at shorter time frames. Because more recent data is more indicative of where they're going. We also do some conversations with our larger members to determine what are their projections of the future. You know, where do they think they're going? Sometimes those conversations are as fruitful as one would like to see, just because they can't share a lot of information due to market forces and
Would you be willing to provide the methodology and calculations used to forecast the scale and usage in future filings?
We'd be more than willing to have the conversations with the commission to walk through some of those, sure.
Just to let you know, from staff's concern, because the basis of the COPA is made on these forecasts, it would be nice to be able to look into them and how you create these calculations. Am I correct that you responded to Commission Investigative Request 9.1 that was sent out last Friday?
Yes.
That is Commission Exhibit 136. I'd like to reference that. Can you please summarize your response for me?
Sure. Ultimately, and maybe I should back up to summarize what we believe the question was to help. Ultimately, we were presented with an Excel file that was reconciling or attempting to recalculate the COPA revenues to be collected. And we were asked to reconcile or balance the differences between the staff model and the values that we were provided in the exhibits that were filed. Ultimately, reconciliation of that, of actual reported numbers to estimates, really isn't real possible because actuals are actual individual data on all of the individual accounts added up, and the estimates are more of a holistic number, looking at the total kilowatt hours reported that month times the COPA factor. So to really get into trying to reconcile that really isn't really possible unless you went through all 20 some thousand accounts and looked at every single one. The main, after reviewing the spreadsheet itself and looking at the main differences in where was in December. So there was a significant over recovery reported in December shown in the spreadsheet that was provided. And the response talked through really what was causing that over-recovery. And it's getting to what you were talking about earlier in the fact that we implemented by billing date, rates by billing date. So if a rate was to go into effect on June 10th, for instance, we would wait until all bills were executed. And the last bill that would be executed before that would be a cycle 4 on June 9th. And then any bills that were issued after that, that rate would go into effect. Hindsight 2020, when we look now back, realizing that that probably shouldn't have happened, shouldn't have done that way, but that's the way our billing cycles were. So if you think through the four billing cycles that Mike referred to, Mr. Easley referred to earlier, we had four up until recently. Those four started from May 1st all the way through July 1st. The first one was May 1st through June 1st, and that wasn't billed until June 15th. So if an order went into effect on June 10th, that billing cycle would have been implemented with the new rate, even though it was usage that was for May. And then the next billing cycle was May 9th through June 9th, May 20th through June 20th, and June 1st through July 1st. And there was a delay in billing. I mean, we had 9 to 15 days after the cycle before we even started to calculate bills. Now, part of the reason we changed what we were doing wasn't because of rate implementation. It was because of risk analysis within the organization. After we did an evaluation of how many days we had outstanding for security deposits coverage from a risk evaluation, we realized that on some of these cycles, we had 75 days of average AR outstanding and a 60-day deposit, which was pretty standard for Precorp on the commercial side, didn't cover that. So that was the first piece. The second piece was this billing cycle not happening until July 9th was in the previous month's calculations for our financials. So it significantly delayed our financials from being issued to the point where we were 45 to 60 days later looking at financials, which isn't acceptable in the environment that we're in right now with volatility. We just couldn't have that. We needed financials much quicker. And now that we've changed things, all of our billing cycles are done by the 9th of the month. So today is the 31st. We're in the process of starting to do some calculations and looking at missing readings and those type of things. All of the billing cycles will be done by February 9th. The revenues will be recorded, everything will be calculated and issued out to the members by then.
So looking at this table, December staff calculated a difference of approximately $322,000. January was $9,400 and February was $900. Between those are the differences that staff calculated between our model and the model provided by the cooperative. And you believe those differences are based on the billing cycles?
The $300,000 that you're referring to, actually, the model that we presented actually came up with a larger over recovery than that. I believe it was $360,000.
The $300,000 I'm referring to is only the difference between the staff calculated and the company reported value. It's not a number that was provided in to compare it to exhibits provided.
And I believe in December, the models that were provided actually showed a December over recovery of about $360,000. So Precorp reconciliation in the model then showed even more of an over collection than this particular responses model that was, or spreadsheet that was provided.
In exhibit, Precorp exhibit 1.2D, would you agree that the annual interest rate needs to be updated in January 2016 for all classes to work 5% of the commission order?
I agree the commission's interest rate in January went up to 1.75%, yes. I'm not sure how that's implemented in this. I would have to read through that and get direction from the commission on how that happens. I've not had a change in interest rate. I'm unfamiliar with that. But I do agree with you that interest rate did change in January.
I have no more questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fish. Mr. Walker, do you have any questions?
Thank you very much for your testimony. I have but one question, and that is, will Precorp provide a working copy of your PCA model with all formulas intact, full documentation, and a key to all of the hard-coded numbers in the future so that we can work directly with the model that you use?
We can definitely work with staff on making sure that our model meets the needs of the commission staff. I am not aware of the specifics of what you're looking for, but we will definitely work with the commission staff in getting references and notations for anything that you're looking for.
I'll try again.
Sure.
Will you provide a copy, a working copy of the model? Stop there.
It is my understanding that we did provide a working copy of all of the exhibits that were provided. So that's where I'm confused. I'm sorry, Mr. Walker.
I understand. So the key is to work with staff to get what we need so next time we don't have to go through all this?
Yes, correct.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Ms. Konski?
Question.
Thank you. Mr. Brandt, do you have questions of this one?
Yes, thank you. In your summary, you mentioned the revenue deferral account. What is the approximate current balance of that?
We just finished closing 2016 numbers. We have a couple of items that haven't come in yet, but at this point, it is just shy of $1.1 million.
Thanks. I realize in your answers to cross-examination that you are being very disciplined about your answers, so I don't want to be too hard on you about this, but I'll have to say the Precor's absolute refusal to dismiss even the wildest example of what it belongs in the COPA and what doesn't is not giving me any comfort about the fact that you don't want us to review it. If you're not going to isolate out anything, if nothing is off limits, I'm sorry, let me back that off. Is there any limit at all, anything that could be in that bill that you would not allow?
I don't know that it's for me to question those items. As I mentioned in cross exam, the contract is not something I negotiate. And so as long as the energy and demand that is on the bill is correct and the rates are in the rate schedule, I'm not involved in those contract negotiations. And I know that that doesn't sound great, but I'm responsible for paying a bill, and that fits with what that says, and that's what that says, that those are the rates that have been provided to us, and those are the demanded energy. Therefore, that is what I should be paying. I think it's beyond my pay grade at this point to be negotiating that contract.
I'm not asking to negotiate the contract. I'm saying if you're looking at a rate schedule from Basin, and there's a line item for a new private jet, is that something you question? Is there any limit to what Basin can charge?
Well, I don't know that we're in that situation, though.
I'm not asking you to just tell me if that was on there, would that cause you any concern?
If there was a line item for a private jet on the bill, that wouldn't be part of the rate schedule. So, yes, that would cause me some alarm. We are looking at specifically what's in that rate schedule and only those things that are in that rate schedule that are on the bill and that are in the agreed upon terms of the contract. Are we pushing through to pay? So yes, there is review that happens. We're not going to just see a miscellaneous charge that hasn't been approved.
Okay. I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Thank you. Deputy Chairman Russell.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Ms. Gold.
Good afternoon.
Could you describe for us the process that Precorp goes through to verify the accuracy of the various components of a rate change that you receive from Basin?
Of the rate change itself?
Yes.
I don't get involved in the rate change itself. I am involved in the power bill. So when a power bill is presented, we review the components of that power bill.
Okay, so maybe I asked the question wrong.
Okay.
For instance, when the new power bill arrived on, what was it, August 1st of last year?
Yeah, it would have been in September, but yes.
September, okay. Yeah. And that's what I was referring to as a rate change. Is that what you're referring to as a power bill?
We would have received a power bill beginning of September that would have had our August usage on it and would have had the new rates on it.
Okay, and what I'm trying to get to now is we know that there are a lot of components to that rate that Basin is charging Precorp. Do you or anyone else at Precorp actually go in and just verify that the components of that that rate change are accurate and reasonable?
The components that we see on a power bill are those that are listed on the rate schedule. So, and I don't know what exhibit is. It was referred to earlier. It shows demand, energy, the contract extension credit. Those are the components that we see when the bill comes to me. There isn't any further detail beyond that that comes with that power bill.
Okay. And that's okay. I accept that. But now, when we see testimony in here that in the current COPA change that we're looking at, that the impact of Dakota gasification is actually still a net benefit to the company, you are just taking the word of Basin on that, and it isn't verified by anybody at Precorp. Would that be correct?
There is no one on my staff that is verifying any of those numbers, no.
Do you know if anyone else in the company looks at that?
I would believe that Mike is involved in meetings. Mr. Easley is involved in meetings that have discussions about those, but I am not involved in those, and neither is in one of my staff.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
I have no questions.
Okay. Ms. Ellsbury, do you have any redirect?
Yes.
Let's proceed.
Ms. Gold, who would you look to for guidance in determining whether there might be an issue with charges that Basin is seeking to pass on that might merit a dispute with Basin?
If there is something that was in question, that would be forwarded on to Mr. Easley for comments.
And does Mr. Easley approve the energy bills from Basin?
Yes, he does.
Are you provided with information about the components of Basin's wholesale rates?
By components, if you mean the demand charge and the energy charge, I received those on the rate schedule. Anything beyond that, no, I'm not provided that unless I receive copies of minutes or such that were presented to the board. There may be comments of a MAC meeting or minutes such as that that might have some data as to that, but an overview of a cost of service or something like that, no, we are not provided that information in the accounting department at Precorp.
And I'm glad that you mentioned demand or energy in terms of components, because I may not be using the same terminology as you. When I say components, in the regular course of business, would you be given information of, you know, Basin's wholesale rates includes X amount to cover Basin's administrative overhead and Y amount to cover these cells? Would you have that information?
No, we would not be provided that information.
And you mentioned MAC meeting minutes. Mr. Easley testified earlier that that's the Manager's Advisory Council, if you get it right. And you understand that he attends those meetings and works with Basin on the components of its rates and or the reasons for increases.
That Object, is leading.
That's true, it is a little leading, but go ahead and answer if you can, so we're going to overrule it.
That's my understanding, yes. And it is my understanding that Mike does attend those meetings.
If the commission agrees with the joint interveners or adopts their suggestion that the commission disallow $13 million approximately of the $18 million pass-on, and considering your testimony that Precorp must continue to pay it for the time being, how will Precorp pay its wholesale bill from Basin?
It would very quickly become a cash flow issue, so we would have to find a way to obtain that cash. Likely it would be borrowing that would come from. The problem with that is this is a significant change in business. So we would have to notify our lenders of that ruling. And any number of things could happen at that point. They could reduce our borrowing, discontinuing our borrowing, not allow us to pull from our line of credit. We do have some cash reserves, but those will be very quickly used.
You said that the likely avenue for Precorp would be borrowing. Is there another alternative that you see?
I don't, cash flows are an issue. So borrowing is your first option. We could, I suppose, go for a general rate case. But I don't know that that would happen quickly enough for that to have an impact, being that rate cases take 12 to 18 months. So we're still going to have a cash flow issue in the immediate term. That's probably the only other option that we would have if, and then it's only if the commission allowed that expense in the general rate case.
Given the amount of time it takes to prepare a general rate case and to notice it, and for the commission to get to investigate it, would Precorp have sufficient cash to pay that basin power bill while the general rate case was pending?
No, not without borrowing. We would not have enough cash available.
No further questions.
Mr. Burbidge, those questions did pose a limited amount of recross if allowed to do so.
Well, it had not been my intention to allow recross, but in the spirit of trying to get as much information as we can on this topic, I would allow limited questioning just to that issue.
Okay. Ms. Kolb, the questions that you just answered in response to Ms. Ellsbury about what would happen if this commission were to grant the relief requested by the joint interveners, it's really speculation on your part, wouldn't you agree?
I realize, as I stated earlier, that until a contract is changed, we are obligated to pay for our wholesale power costs. So it's under that understanding that those statements have been made.
It's called the decision of what to do if this commission enters an order that says $13 million of the $18 million COPA filing is disallowed is a decision above your job position. Wouldn't you agree?
A negotiation of the contract is not something I get involved in, yes.
And the decision of what course of action, of whether to borrow funds, whether to file a general rate case, whether to sit down at the table with Basin and say, we, Basin and Precorp, have a problem, are decisions for the chief executive officer following directives of the board of directors. Isn't that true?
In many cases, yes.
Mr. Hickey, I believe these questions that she's answered, that these sorts of issues were above her pay grade. So if there's something new. That
was actually my last question.
Okay. Thank you. Does that lead to any redirect by
no, Ms. Ellsbury? No, it does not.
Okay, thank you. You may be excused, Ms.
Thank
Cole.
You.
Ms. Good, if you would call your next witness, please.
Precorp calls Mark Foss to the stand.
Mr. Foss, you would raise your right hand. Do you swear that the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, subject to penalty?
Thank you.
Excuse me, your witness.
Thank you. Mr. Foss, will you please state your name for the record?
I'm Mark Daniel Foss.
And where are you employed?
I am employed with Basin Electric Power Cooperative.
What's your position with Basin?
My title is Senior Vice President and General Counsel.
How long have you been in each of those positions?
Well, I'd be with respect to employment with either Basin Electric or Dakota Gasification Company. I started in August of 1978. I worked for Basin until November of 1988, when we purchased the coal gasification plant, at which time I became general counsel of Dakota Gasification Company. I came back and started working with the Basin Legal Group about 2003, and then became general counsel of Basin Electric in 2015.
Did you file testimony in this particular matter?
I did.
Have you had a chance to review that testimony before appearing today?
Yes, I read it again yesterday.
Are there any corrections to your testimony that you'd like to make?
No, none.
Do you believe that your testimony on direct exam here today, under oath, would be similar to that in your pre-filed testimony?
Absolutely.
With that in mind, would you please summarize your testimony for the commission?
My testimony, prepared testimony, was essentially provided a history of both the gasification plant as well as Basin Electric's involvement in the plant. Really, to understand the plant, you have to go back to the oil embargo by OPEC in the early 1970s. And the resulting energy boom, if you will, in this part of the world, North Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, Colorado, whether it be oil production, natural gas production, the opening of several coal mines, all of which these facilities, of course, require electrical power and energy. As I'm sure the commission is well aware, the electrical system in the United States is split up into three separate uninterconnected systems, the eastern system, the western system, and parts of Texas. Basin is unusual in that it has customers in both the western system and the eastern system. And so to meet this demand for electrical power and energy, which of course is occurring outside of incorporated cities and therefore in the cooperative territories, Basin had to meet this demand and decided to meet it with coal-fired power plants. We initially planned, sited, and began building the Laramie River Station in Laramie, Wyoming, with a coalition of other public-type consumer-owned utilities, and that was to address the load growth on the west. On the east, we were looking for a plant site. Meanwhile, there was a group based out of Michigan, Detroit specifically, Michigan-Wisconsin Pipeline, and that company had a dream that what was then, ironically, thought to be a shortage of natural gas. It was commonly believed then that the United States was going to run out of natural gas. This company believed that they could build a series of coal gasification plants, mostly in North Dakota, to fill that void. They had gotten contractual rights to coal reserves. They had applied for and received a water permit. They had two major issues, one of which is the gasification process can only use particles of coal of a certain size, and if they're too small, they clog up the gasifiers. And so the initial plan was to take these fines back into the coal mine and bury the coal back up. The second problem they had was power supply. They talked to the local investor-owned utilities that serve in North Dakota, then Northern States Power, Otter Tail Electric, and Montana Dakota Utilities, none of whom had any interest in serving the facility at all. So they approached Basin Electric asking if we would be interested in the power supply. We described our needs, and the decision was made that, you know, what they had and what they needed and what we had and what we needed would be a good fit. The one thing I should add at the outset, sort of a wrinkle in the entire thing, is as they applied for approval of this process with the FERC, and our understanding when we contracted with these people, is this gasification plant was going to be a zero risk facility, that the plant, that the partners that built the plant were going to get an order from FERC that assured them that they would collect 100% of the cost of manufacturing gas from the local distribution companies that they sold to. And of course, this was at a time when the natural gas pipeline business was integrated, that meaning that the natural gas pipeline companies both bought and transported gas. They proceeded, they got the order that they wanted. Unfortunately, it was appealed by a number of consumer groups. Unfortunately, I think for all of us, they agreed to a settlement. The settlement let the project go through, let the cost be passed through. However, it created two price caps on what could be passed through. One was the price of natural gas could be no higher than the energy equivalent of diesel fuel. And the second cap, and the one that most people thought that would be, because it was the higher of the two caps, the second cap was their highest average price, 10% gas. As I mentioned, this was back when the natural gas business was a regulated one, and prices were quite high. They agreed to the caps, they proceeded with construction of the facility, but in that interim, we had actually gone forward with the Antelope Valley Station, thinking that the need for power was so immediate that we couldn't wait. As a result, a number of the undertakings that the gasification plant was going to accomplish, for example, the drainage ditch, the rail facilities, the water treatment facilities, Basin Electric agreed it would do those instead. And we granted the partners then an option, should they get that FERC certificate, that they could take the option and enter into the contract and receive these services from us. As I said, contrary to what the original plan was, we were originally going to receive those services from them. When this project was being constructed, along with ABS, it was the largest construction site in the United States. Startup, as you might well imagine, given a unique facility like this, was difficult, but I think the employees were quite proud to be able to bring it online. Unfortunately, while they were sort of working a technical miracle, FERC had deregulated the natural gas business. FERC had ordered issued Order 500, which allowed pipeline basically forced the gas pipeline companies to get out of the merchant function. They could only be transporters. And they allowed the pipeline companies to buy down these contracts. The buyout price then could be passed through to their consumers. So you saw the average price of natural gas nosedive. The highest 10% followed that. And it was readily apparent on the day they basically declared the plant to be in commercial operation that it was going to be an absolute financial failure. So there was a provision in the contracts that allowed them to basically say, DOE guaranteed the financing for this project. 75% of it was provided by a loan from the Federal Financing Bank. And the way we always described it, on August 1st, 1984, they threw the keys to the DOE and said, it's all yours. The DOE initially announced that they were going to close the plant. One advantage Basin Electric has of having members throughout an 8-9 state area is each of those 8-9 states have senators, House of Representatives. So we contacted the membership contacted the congressional representatives, and we put a lot of pressure on the DOE. DOE subsequently reversed itself and said that they would continue to operate the plant until they could find a buyer. They did then announce, I believe in 1986, that their intent to purchase the plant. In 1987, they started the formal bidding process. Basin Electric, given the various contracts and responsibilities that it took on with this joint project, and in particular, the large economies of scale of a larger mine versus a smaller mine, calculated that if the plant closed, it would cost us $37 million a year, which at that point in time would be a 7 mil increase. We were very concerned that what would happen, and it was something that we saw with some of our fellow generations transmission cooperatives throughout the country. There were a number of them that, like us, built generation for load that didn't develop. So at this particular time, Basin Electric had 2,000 megawatts of generation and 1,000 megawatts of load. This was a 90 megawatt load, so it was 9% of our load, number one. And then number two, this is a plant that operates 24/7, so it was a high capacity load. As a result, as I said, we decided to bid on the project. We had one serious competitor, and that was the Coastal Corporation, which in the interim had become the parent company of the original pipeline sponsor. We were well aware that, as I mentioned earlier, the buyout buy-down regulation that FERC had passed, this facility would qualify that for that. So what we were concerned about is Coastal would operate the facility to use all the tax benefits associated with it. You had both investment tax credit, another 10% energy credit, and then you had production tax credits associated with each MCF that was produced by the plant. And after locking in their tax benefits, entering into a buyout buy-down and closing the plant. So long story short, we were the successful bidder. The bid was structured to minimize the amount of capital at risk. There was $15 million that was bid for the natural gas pipeline that's between Northern Border Pipeline and the gasification plant. And then we agreed to pay $69 million for half of the mining equipment that was in the mine, with the thought that if everything went south, we would be able to recapture that investment by selling this equipment. In terms of the balance of the offer, the bid, or ultimately the agreement, we agreed to waive the tax benefits associated with ownership, so the federal government was no longer subsidizing the operation. And then we agreed to profit share. And the profit sharing was established by a table that set a price for gas in each of the first 15 years, as well as an escalator based on increases or decreases in inflation. And to the extent that the average price of gas in a given year exceeded that bogey, those amounts then were paid to the Department of Energy. The one thing I should, as I mentioned in my testimony, the acquisition was approved by the membership of Basin Electric. And when I say that, I don't mean the board of directors, but I mean all of the Class A members, all of the Class C members of the distribution cooperative members. It was a unanimous vote, and included in that vote were Precor's predecessors, if you will, put quotes on that, Tri-County and Sheridan Johnson. So with that, we have operated then the plant since October 31st, 1988. As I said, the original deal got changed, and so there are a number of facilities that Basin Electric owns that DGC pays for. One of the key ones is you have two 230 kilovolt transmission lines between the Antelope Valley Station and our initial coal-fired generating station in North Dakota, the Leland Oil Station, 17 miles away. There are two lines between those two facilities. Dakota Gasification Company pays for one of those. We share the costs between the two companies of the rather substantial rail loading and unloading facility. We have a drainage facility, and in addition to that, since then, I believe Mr. Easley talked about the pipeline between the gasification plant and Antelope Valley Station. That provides startup fuel for the Antelope Valley Station. But in addition to that, substantially all of the fuel for the Antelope Valley Station is sold to Basin Electric by Dakota Gasification Company in the form of those fines. The other thing I would mention, and again, I think it was touched on in Mr. Easley's testimony or response to questions to Mr. Easley, is the gasification plant is interconnected with Northern Border Pipeline. The gas that the gasification plant sells is sold on Northern Border Pipeline. And all of the gas generation that Basin Electric has constructed in the last few years basically interconnects with Northern Border Pipeline. And as he said, you obviously in the gas business, just like the electric business, you can't trace a molecule from here to there, but we do then sell gas for the basin generation facilities on an ongoing basis. And then something that is a cost saving is we're basically the backup or the supplier for those facilities in terms of certifying them as capacity in the SPP system. So I think that covers it.
Mr. Foss, you talked about how all the gas lines are interconnected during that part of your summary. Can you get into how the DGC costs are passed on?
Well, I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding here, and the very predicate of this case is incorrect. There are no DGC costs that are passed through to Basin Electric. Somebody doesn't come in from DGC into Sue's office and go, gosh, Sue, we can't pay this month. Could you pay it? That's not how it works. They're separate independent corporations. The dealings between them are at arm's length and contractual.
So have you heard these hypotheticals about the minor league baseball team and the car dealership?
I have, and I think the baseball question could be referred to Ms. Sorensen because she actually worked for an investor-owned utility that had a baseball season, but team. But yes, I have, and they are completely hypothetical because it couldn't happen. Basin Electric goes into the markets, borrows billions of dollars from insurance companies and banks. We have an indenture, we have loan agreements, we have note purchase agreements that circumscribe what we can do. And we are in the energy business, the electric energy business, as well as the DGC business. And we would not be allowed to go into fast foods or a baseball team, car wash, car dealership. The people that basically finance the entire operation, and reasonably so, want to limit us to the business that we're in.
You got into this a little bit, but didn't go, I think, all the way into it. You talked about the relationship between DGC and AVS, Antelope Valley Station. Can you explain how that is electricity related and other ties that make DGC electricity related?
Well, I'll start with the, as I did before, mentioned before, rather, Dakota Gasification provides a fuel supplier for the Antelope Valley Station, substantially all of the lignite coal, except when instances where the gasification plant is down for a long-term outage. In addition, with respect to the mine serves three facilities. It serves the Leland Old Station, the Antelope Valley Station, and the gasification plant. And those three facilities really effectively are one single industrial complex, such that to the extent that Leland Old Station isn't running or is running less than we would like it to, that affects the amount of coal taken from the mine. And as a result, if less coal is taken from the mine, it makes the remaining tons all the more expensive. So that would be one example. I talked about the natural gas both for starting up the Antelope Valley Station as well as for fueling our different gas generation facilities that we built up and down Northern Border Pipeline. And then, as I mentioned, you know, you have a rail facility. The coal to get to the Leland Old Station is actually delivered at the Antelope Valley Station, and then it is trucked through the Antelope Valley Station, through the gasification plant, 17 miles over to the Leland Old Station. So that's a facility that's used both for Antelope Valley, the rail is used both for Antelope Valley, Leland Old, and the gasification plant. And then, of course, you know, the drainage facilities and just sort of some common assets like that. And then last but not least, I mentioned the 17-mile, 230-kilovolt reliability line between AVS and the Leland Old Station that Dakota Gasification pays for.
I want you to tie AVS to Basin somehow in the event anybody doesn't understand how that actually plays into Basin. How much of Basin's coal needs at AVS does DGC provide?
Typically 100%. as I said, it would only be if the gasification plant is down and not operating. Once every 10 years, we have a black plant because we have two trains of the plant. And so typically it is rare, if ever, that the plant goes down unless you plan it to, because you can always go back and forth to one of the trains in the system. There are, nonetheless, for reliability and safety purposes, inspections you need to do once every 10 years. So once every approximately 10 years, we will shut the entire plant down and do inspections we can only do with the entire plant down. And then there's also frequently some work that can only be done with the entire plant down. So it's only that exception that's the only time that DGC isn't providing ABS with its coal requirement.
And the final step of that then is, what percent of basin's baseload power does ABS provide?
Again, as I said at the very beginning, I talked about the western and the eastern interconnected system. ABS is two 450 megawatt units, so it's 900 megawatts. In terms of baseload, it represents approximately 50% of our baseload generation in the east. And on a total system basis, east and west, it represents about 25%.
We were talking about the use of the pipeline. Were there any plans to use the gas pipeline for anything other than startup gas for ABS?
Well, that's a good question, actually. As I think everyone in coal country is well aware, the Clean Power Plan, if it would finalize, would be a drastic blow to the coal industry in Wyoming, North Dakota in particular. It's almost like they picked us out and said, let's whack these guys. So one of the exercises that our engineering department has done, given the access that the Antelope Valley Station has to gas, is, would you be able to use natural gas for something more than startup? And we found that we would be able to reduce carbon emissions at the Antelope Valley Station anywhere from 10 to maybe as much as 20% by increasing the use of natural gas, which, you know, God forbid we have to do that. But if the Clean Power Plan came into fruition or went into effect, that would be something we would be looking at doing.
Did you hear the question earlier about whether Precor had ever done any third-party analysis of DGC?
Yes.
Has Basin ever done any third-party analysis of DGC or requested third-party analysis?
Well, I mean, the answer, have you been asked? Yes. As you might well imagine, there is not a lot of expertise in the coal gasification business. I believe there is a small coal gasification facility operating in Kansas that makes fertilizers. It uses a different process than we do. There is the process or the plant down in Mississippi that we think someday will get finished. And again, a different technology. The only other facility using the Lurgi coal gasification technology that's used at the Great Plains Synfuels plant is Sasol in South Africa. So in terms of trying to bring in outside engineering expertise to look over our shoulder and tell us if we're doing this right, the first thing you have to do is have your engineers come in, sit down, and explain how your system works. In other words, you've got to do the foundation education, and you're basically paying them to tell you what you told them, which, people have asked us to do it, don't get me wrong, but we've been disinclined on that technical side. In terms of business analysis, I think what we have looked at in the past is there a market for the plant? Could we get rid of this thing? And the people at work always tease me quite a bit because I've said, probably forever, how are you going to get rid of this thing? It's so interconnected to, you know, the basin operation. You don't know where basin starts and the plant ends. And the people that we've had come in as potential bidders, most of them have walked away going, well, no, this is just too intertwined with the basin operation for me to get comfortable with it. So we've never had a real bid for it. I think the last time we went through an exercise like this a few years ago, it was right about the time we were looking at going forward with the urea plant. We were talking to a hedge fund that actually had purchased the fertilizer plant that I mentioned in Kansas that uses coal gasification. So we were kind of going, oh, great, finally somebody that knows what we're talking about, knows the process, knows the potential here. And basically their offer was, it wasn't even, we will take it for free. It was, we'll take it, you finish the urea plant for us. So as I said, it's just too incestuous a relationship, if you will, for somebody on the outside to get comfortable with coming in and purchasing this, thinking it's any type of standalone facility, because it's not.
Mr. Burbridge will pass the witness for questions.
Thank you. Mr. Hickey, cross-examination.
Thank you. Mr. Roselli will.
Mr. Roselli, your witness.
Mr. Foss, good afternoon. My name is Philip Roselli. I'm one of the attorneys for the joint interveners, as you probably know. I'm going to start with this. I don't think you and I are going to be getting into numbers together.
Good.
But
at least not, I don't know about you, but I know I wouldn't do a very good job.
Well, at least not deeply into numbers, but as a cautionary note, and I'm going to certainly have this discussion with Ms. Sorensen, I'm going to ask you to keep me honest and vice versa, that we both need to always be mindful that as we're discussing numbers, we always need to be thinking, is this a confidential data point, particularly something that Precorp has designated as confidential? Will you do that with me?
Absolutely.
Mr. Roselli, does it make sense before you get started with your cross-examination, go ahead and break now and come back at a quarter till and proceed there? Or
Mr. Rivers, that's fine with me.
Well, why don't we go ahead and do that? Let's break until 2:45, and at which time we'll reconvene.